You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you all very much for braving this morning's inclement weather to come out and join us. We have a really tremendous panel, I think, that I hope you'll find interesting. My name is Homi Karas. I'm a senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Group at Brookings. And it's a privilege for me to welcome President Shinichi Kitaoka, the president of JICA, the Japanese aid agency, to Brookings. I think this is the president's first visit to Brookings, even though he has been passing through Washington on many occasions. So I'm especially delighted to have him here. So the topic that we're going to discuss, which is essentially how do we do development in places where which are very difficult, very tough. I think that this is one of the principal questions that people who are interested in development, people who are interested in ending extreme poverty, will have to face as we go forward. In many other places where we've achieved security, where we've achieved reasonably strong states, we have progress at varying rates, but we have progress in reducing poverty. We sort of know the kinds of things that can be done that can help. In conflict-affected states, we've achieved very little progress. If we really seriously want to get to zero, we have to address this issue, and we have to address it frontally. About a year ago, we did a research project with the support of JICA, and I'm very grateful to them for that, looking at some of these issues. And we concluded from that one of the principal outstanding issues is what do we do in conflict-affected states? And so I'm really pleased to continue this this discussion. I think it's something that when you look at the news today, there's almost a sense that, you know, let's just throw up our hands. It's hopeless. I mean, some of the news is so bad that I think we forget that actually there have been a series of things that have worked, that we do have some experiences that we can build upon. And so I'd like to ask our panel and the president to give some remarks about what those experiences are. How do we move forward with this agenda? President Kitaoka has just taken over as JICA's president in October of last year. Prior to that, he was president of the International University of Japan. He's got a very long and distinguished career in academia. He's also been in government. He's been the ambassador at the UN in the mid-2000s. And in that position, I believe he was very instrumental in generating real support in Japan for the Millennium Development Goals. So I trust that he's going to do exactly the same for the Sustainable Development Goals. He's been a strong supporter of the Millennium Villages program. And what he brings is a very long career and experience of thinking about Japan's role in the world order, how we deal with development cooperation in a world which is changing very rapidly and in a world where these issues of security and development are increasingly interlinked, something that for development practitioners is a very new idea. We've spent decades actually trying to build silos and separate the security and the development aspects of international cooperation, thinking that that would help protect development dollars. Today, I think everybody understands that that has to be broken down and we have to merge these two together. So with that, let me turn it over to President Kitaoka. He's going to deliver some opening remarks. After his remarks, he'll be joined by the rest of our panel. I'll introduce them after his remarks. We'll have a short moderated discussion on some of the issues that he raises, and then we'll open the floor for Q&A. We'll try to end this program at 11:30. President, please.
Thank you very much, Homi, for this very kind introduction. It's really a great pleasure and honor for me to be here at this very great institution, particularly in this 100th anniversary year. I'm very happy to be here. I've been a frequent visitor to Washington, D.C. as a lecturer or a participant to many symposiums mainly on security issues. Particularly in the past 3 years, I have been the chair or deputy chair of 3 advisory panels to Prime Minister Abe on security issues and as well as historical issues. But I don't know why. I have never been here at Brookings. I'm very sorry about that. So I have been very much looking forward to coming here as the president of Japan's the development agency to discuss fragility and security in such an influential and respected place. As was pointed out by Homi, nowadays the development and security are inseparable. We should have more cooperation between two areas. That's probably why I was appointed to this post by the Prime Minister. Needless to say, Japan is one of the global players. But Japan's foreign policy has been handicapped by two weak points we had. One was that Japan's security policy is not sufficiently self-reliant. We depend too much on other countries, mainly the United States. The second stems from the criticism from our neighboring countries, South Korea and China, on historical perception issues. But in the past few years, we have made some improvements on these two points. Last year, the security-related legislation was adopted in September by the Congress, and also the Prime Minister Abe issued on the 70th anniversary of the end of the World War II, he presented a very good statement, which was very received by most of the international community. And also toward the end of the year, last year, there was an agreement between the governments of Japan and South Korea on the issue of comfort women. So the weak points are weakened, if not solved completely. The Abe administration has been proposing that Japan should become a more proactive contributor to peace. And this means that Japan should play a more important role in bringing stability and peace all over the world. And for that purpose, it is necessary for Japan to increase the role of the self-defense forces. But the role of self-defense forces is very much limited. The more important role should be shouldered by JICA, by assisting other countries by non-military means. And that's why I'm very happy to be able to give my talk in my capacity today. Today I'd like to talk about the kinds of contributions to peace and stability JICA has made and will continue to make, particularly in conflict-affected areas. My expertise was the history of modern Japan. So let me start briefly on the history of Japan's international cooperation. During World War II, Japan fought against the United States and many other countries, causing terrible destruction and also suffering awful damage on its own before it surrendered in 1945. Fortunately, Japan was able to recover rather rapidly with the assistance from many countries and organizations, particularly from the United States. Above all, Gariowa and Iriwa. Gariowa is now many people have forgotten, probably, government assistance and relief in occupied area. And Iriwa means something similar to that. And then they provided a huge amount of money to Japan. Within 6 years, starting in 1946, a total of $1.8 billion. And of that $1.8 billion of aid, $1.3 billion were given as grant. Others are loan. But two-thirds were a grant. This should not be forgotten. And many Japanese leaders have not forgotten this important fact. On the part of Japan, Japan's international cooperation started with the process of reparations. Around 1954-55, Japan started its reparation first toward Burma. At the same time, Japan joined the Colombo Plan. Colombo Plan is not as famous as it used to be, but anyhow, it was proposed in 1950. Colombo Plan was a collaborative organization that supports the economic and social development of Asia and Pacific. And it was the first international organization formed to help developing countries in the wake of World War II. Japan became a member of Colombo Plan as early as 1954. It was only 9 years after Japan's surrender. And then Japan did serious effort to regain the trust from the international community by implementing reparations and also by joining this Colombo Plan, to Japan started to help those poor countries in Asia. Well, Japan's international cooperation in Asia served to stabilize countries and help develop their economies, create jobs, and reduce poverty. Particularly, it started with South Asia, but main focus moved to Southeast Asia or East Asia, including Northeast Asia. Though many countries are not particularly democratic, or rather undemocratic, but still most of the leaders in those countries are, development-oriented, partly to counter the threat of communism. They try to focus on nation building by developing industry, by establishing infrastructure, by strengthening their education, blah, 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 to which Japan did a lot of assistance. Well, I'm not saying that Japan's assistance to East Asian countries was always successful, but as a whole, I think this was a great success. As the book of Matthew says, a tree is known by its fruit. Now look at the situation of East Asian countries. We have forgotten the fact that the level of standard of living in East Asian countries was about the same in the 1950s as the sub-Saharan countries. Until 1960s, the GDP per capita of East Asian countries was roughly about the same at the level of $500 a year per capita. Now, East Asian countries' GDP per capita averaged $8,000, while sub-Saharan African countries is around $2,000. The most notable case was South Korea. And then while South Korean per capita was $130 in 1966, only 50 years ago, now it's at $28,000 2 years ago. That's why I say that the tree is known by its root. So therefore I say that Japan's success assistance was as a whole great success. After that, in response to international appeals to allocate more resources to other areas, Japan began to expand its assistance to other areas, including South Asia, Middle East, Africa, Latin America, and also Central Asia, blah, blah, blah. Now it's Japan is doing a lot of assistance to all over the countries. And then JICA has an office in more than 100 countries. Since the late 1990s, Japan has advocated for the protection of human security, that this concept of human security became the core of Japan's assistance. JICA's assistance, JICA's cooperation is also rooted in this concept of human security. It is no longer possible to only look at national security, particularly after the end of the Cold War. You know, many countries cannot take care of the security of the people. We have to take care of the individual security of the people rather than take care of the national security only. That's why we have started to promote this concept of human security. But we can say that this is not a particularly new idea. The origin of this concept can be found in the UN Charter, for example, in the first article, which stated about the purpose of the United Nations, and also the Universal Declaration of Human Rights drafted by Eleanor Roosevelt, we can find a similar concept that everyone has a right to live in dignity. Everyone should be treated equally, things like that. And this is also written in the preamble of Japan's constitution. It says, we recognize that all people of the world have the right to live in peace, free from fear and want. I strongly support this section of the constitution, though I have some reservations on other part. Well, to achieve these ideals, we must move beyond focusing only on directly fulfilling the needs. We must also help all people live with dignity. This way of thinking has been consistent in the concept of Japan's aid for a long time. Though not always explicitly recognized, the explicit expression started in the late 1990s, but we can trace the origin of the concept well before. That's what I'm trying to say. The now, empowering the people is the main objective. This is another concept of Japan's assistance. We are just as supporters. The major players are the people over there. What we can do is limited. We can assist them. And then not only, rather than giving the charity from above, we have to create a partnership, respecting their ownership and the empowerment of those people. This is our basic policy. The human security is a rather ambiguous concept, which is not understood very clearly by many countries at the United Nations. It was first inserted in a UN document when Bruce was assisting Kofi Annan in 2015. But recently, in 2012, the UN adopted a resolution about the definition of human security, saying that This is the right of the people to live in freedom and dignity, free from poverty and despair. And then this is, you can find out, SDGs is quite similar to this. You know, we can say that SDGs is an advanced and expanded version of our human security. Today, unfortunately, many people still live in unstable environments and face enormous difficulties. As I said, Japan's approach is not to give charity, but to support them to stand up by their own foot. Well, for example, goal 3 of the SDG is to ensure healthy lives and promote well-being for all at all ages. This idea constitutes the core concept of human security. Though the SDG is very wide and complicated, but we believe that the health should be one of the cores in SDGs, because the life is equal to everyone. Life is important for everyone. We are focusing on the implementation of universal health coverage. Prime Minister Abe contributed an article to the journal Lancet on the importance of public health. We organized a very important international conference in December last year, and again another conference in February in Tokyo on this issue. It is important to strengthen the resilience of the economy and the society as a whole by developing efficient health system. You know, in health, prevention is easier and less costly than curing. Therefore, we should pay more attention to the establishment of the very good system. One of the systems is, as some of you know, that mother-child healthcare book in Japan, which was created by Japan. This is a handbook to be handed to a woman when she becomes pregnant. And she is expected to write every important record about the date of discovery and when the baby was born and how heavy he or she was, what kind of shots were given to him or her, kind of thing. In this, most important, the records are included. And then this is a very basic tool, and we are exporting this one to various countries. Many countries are exporting this one. And this helped the reduction of child mortality quite a lot, first of all in Japan and in various countries. Such countries like Thailand or in Kenya, in Africa, are the partners on this issue. Okay, creating the system is very important when we have to fight against Ebola or Zika or many issues. And as a whole, it's much cheaper than giving the assistance after the things happened. JICA's mission is to provide end-to-end aid and deliver the best possible benefits to partner countries through the combination of ODA loans, grant aid, and technical cooperation. JICA do this all three kind of assistances, loans, grant, and technical cooperation. And I'd like to introduce you to interesting cases. One is on South Sudan. The other is on Mindanao in the Philippines. South Sudan is a very new country, which declared its independence in July 2011. Japan has been providing humanitarian development assistance, but also playing an important role in nation building and working toward peace in South Sudan by sending self-defense forces in the framework of UN peacekeeping operations. But even before independence, JICA started its effort to help them. JICA has been involved in a range of sectors. We have extended assistance to improve roads, bridges, and other basic infrastructure to ensure steady supplies of drinking water, to strengthen food security. There are many, many kind of things. JICA also has worked to build local capacity. For instance, we support the Juba College of Nursing and Midwifery, which is the first school for registered nurses and midwives established by the South Sudanese government. I must acknowledge that there are limits to the extent to which development can facilitate the establishment of peace. Political compromise is first of all necessary. But at the same time, we have to support the lives of people. I would like to introduce a very, very interesting case recently, which took place recently. In January, we supported the first national sports tournament in South Sudan, and which was named as National Unity Day. Many athletes got together beyond the differences of tribes to Juba, and they engaged in athletic games. And then the event was really successful, wonderful successful, beyond expectation. The day's events moved some participants to tears. They were saying that they had never dreamed of this kind of day might come. But actually, the idea of ancient Olympic Games had the same origin, we can remember. The next example I'd like to talk about is the island of Mindanao, which I visited last month. In 2014, the Aquino administration signed a historic peace agreement with the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, which is seeking more autonomy from the central government. This agreement maps out the political process for establishing a new autonomous government this summer. Unfortunately, due to some incidents and the fact that the country is going into the election time, election is always difficult, brings about some difficulty, like in this country. Well, the formation of new autonomous government has been delayed. But we are supporting patiently for more than 10 years or so in this process. You know, recently I attended a ceremony of the groundbreaking ceremony for the farm-to-market road, the connecting the farm, which is under the influence of Moro, to the market, so that they can bring their agricultural good to the market, contributing to the benefit. And then, you know, in a sense, Moro is weakening. There is some kind of indifference on the part of Manila that they will disappear, or they will, they can crush the Moro. But this is a very dangerous idea. You know, if they are very much weakened, if we cannot embrace them, then probably the younger generation of those Moro people may contact with Daesh. That's very dangerous. We have to embrace them. And the JICA is trying to help Philippine government to embrace them by providing these kind of assistances. This is one of the areas which JICA is engaged in. I'm very proud and appreciative that empowering people through these means has borne fruit over there. You know, in that sense, that road that connected the farm and market is a kind of, I'd like to call it, as a peace dividend in advance. You know, if you are going to make your peace, then we will give more assistance to them. This will be a very effective. I hope that the next administration will support this peace process with our continuous support to the Mindanao. Well, in addition to these two examples, I have to touch upon the briefly on Syrian crisis. Well, it's the forced displaced persons. The situation is really terrible. We are not in a position to join militarily over there. But we are trying to do our best to support refugees. And then when the Iraqi government is getting back some places, some cities from Daesh, then we have to make some support for the restoration of the living condition over there, water system, cities, houses, and so forth. We are trying to do our best. And then this reminds me of the role we are. We have been in very good relation with Syria before the crisis. We have sent many young volunteers in Syria. Now it's too dangerous to go. But our young volunteers was created in the 1960s. It was modeled for after the Peace Corps in the United States. Recently, I met with Ambassador Carolyn Kennedy in Tokyo, and she showed great interest in another cooperation between Japan's volunteer and Peace Corps in the United States. And that's a very good idea, I think. We just promised to make a visit to the training center in Japan together in June. Well, the situation is very difficult, but we have to continue to help those people. Now, this year, 2016, is a very important year for Japan and for JICA. Japan has been a non-permanent member of the Security Council from January this year. We are going to be participating in World Humanitarian Summit in May in Istanbul, and Japan is going to host G7 summit meeting in Japan. And in addition, Tokyo International Conference on African Development, TICAD, will be held first in Africa in Nairobi, Kenya, in late August. So overall, Japan is in a position to take the lead to fight against the difficulty today. This is a very good opportunity for Japan to show that Japan is playing a more important role than before to the peace and stability of the world. As a whole, the world situation is very gloomy, with a lot of terrorism, extreme ideas, and a terrible gap between the too rich and too poor people. That's really terrible. But on the other hand, we should not forget that we adopted. There were two milestones in the last year on international cooperation. That's one, adoption of sustainable development goals at the United States in September, and also the Paris Agreement on climate change in December in Paris. These are two milestones for international cooperation. So this year, 2016, is the first year after those two milestones. That's why I believe that Japan has a very important role to play to show that the international cooperation has to be a real one. Thank you very much.
Let me invite our panel to come up and take their seats. And as they're getting mic'd up, I'll briefly introduce them. Sitting in the middle is Sharon Morris. Sharon is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern, Western Hemisphere, and European Affairs in the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations in the State Department. So I guess Near East, terrible part of the world in terms of security. Europe, also major issues in terms of security. I'm glad you're spending a lot of time in the Western Hemisphere, Sharon, to give you a little bit of peace and quiet. But she has a very long experience with development cooperation before being in joining the State Department. She was in the United States Institute of Peace, where she was a senior fellow. She's also been in an NGO. She was in USAID before. She's worked at the MacArthur Foundation. So she's worked in a whole range of organizations focused on this key issue of the links between security and development. To her right on the far side is Joel Hellman. Joel is the dean of the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He's been in that position for about a year now. Prior to that, he was for many years, probably at least 15 or so, I would guess, at the World Bank, where we had the pleasure of being colleagues together. At the World Bank, Joel was responsible for setting up what was called the Governance Hub in Nairobi in Kenya, which was a specialized unit at the World Bank to think about and guide all of the World Bank operations in fragile and conflict-affected states. And last, but by no means least, sitting right here is Bruce Jones. Bruce is the Vice President of the Foreign Policy Program here at Brookings. Amongst many other responsibilities, but the one I particularly like is a project that he heads, which is very optimistically called From Chaos to Order. You know, Bruce is a specialist in entropy, but what he has also done is spent a lot of his career in thinking about the balancing of different powers, the accommodation of new powers, and particularly when one thinks about security challenges, I think they have to be put in the context of what's going on in the rest of the world. These are very rarely purely local security issues. They're embedded in broader forces that are at play in the at the world economy. Bruce also has hands-on experience. He was served in the UN operation in Kosovo. As the president mentioned, he was a senior advisor to Kofi Annan. He was one of the main authors of the World Bank's very influential report on conflict and development, and he was also on the UN's high-level panel on threats, challenges, and change. So we have a wonderful panel. And Sharon, I thought I would start off with you. And, you know, in the president's remarks, I thought it was really interesting to hear his the emphasis that he placed on human security on the individual level. We know that in, you know, in some areas like health and lives saved, if you look at Afghanistan, the results, as far as we can tell, are absolutely stellar. Afghanistan has halved in a matter of a few years infant and child mortality rates. They've increased life expectancy from about 50 to 60 plus. So at the individual level, we seem to be able to achieve some successes. But at the national state level, that doesn't seem to be translating into greater stability. So when you think about these sets of issues, how do you balance these questions of are we investing in people and trying to do something for individuals, or are we really trying to build the institutions of the state for sustainability? The president also said we can at best be a catalyst, a supporter of development in these places. We can't be actually the instrumental. So that means having some kind of organization to support. So give us a few comments on this balance between the individual and the state.
Yeah. I first of all, I'm not sure I would see it as two things that are in opposition. I think for me, over the years, I have looked at this question of violence from a development perspective, from I was actually seconded to the military when I was in Afghanistan, from an academic perspective, and now from the perspective of the State Department and diplomacy. And I think what I have learned over time is that development assistance is absolutely vital in these places. I would never argue that it isn't. I think we need to continue to provide assistance in conflict and post-conflict environments. I think what has become increasingly clear to me is that many of our development programs were developed for very stable places. And so when we pick them up and we drop them into highly unstable environments, they don't have the results that we would like them to have. They may benefit folks at the individual level, but that can easily get overwhelmed by conflict dynamics down the road. And so one of the things that I've advocated for over the years is that we need to integrate development and peace building, or conflict management, if you want to call it that, because I have seen in many places when you put development resources in violent places, there are a number of distortions that come up, zero-sum competition, no trust, deep tensions between communities. And if you put development assistance into a context like that and you don't grapple with those issues, very often the assistance can just end up being another resource in a violent and competitive game. I think where I've gone from that is not only am I an advocate of putting together development and peace building in everything we do in violent environments, I have seen too many programs reinforce tensions as opposed to bridge them. But I think I'm also, one of the reasons I came back into government and am at CSO, is that even development and peace building, even if we could integrate those two, isn't enough. One of the things that I'm responsible for in CSO is the Atrocity Prevention Board. And it is very clear that in many places, there's no way to mediate your way out of a problem. So even if you have mediation linked to development, there are spoilers, there are bad actors, there are people who are going to do what they do. And they are going to keep places unstable because it benefits them. And so now we're beginning to look very carefully at how do you use diplomacy in a more effective way to deal with the spoilers, to provide a great graceful exit for those leaders who are not going to promote a particular peace-building agenda. Because ultimately conflict is deeply political. So until we have development layered with a recognition of the violent dynamics, paired with peace building, layered with diplomacy, I just don't think we can keep putting money into these places and expect it to work. So,
thank you. Bruce, do you want to pick up on this? How do we identify who are the spoilers? When Sharon says graceful exit, does she mean to Panama these days? What are the practicalities of actually integrating these kinds of things?
Yeah, let me build on that and amplify it in one place. Let me just, before I do it, let me make one other point. These days, when you hear the debate on these issues, we were talking about this in the green room earlier. It's all Afghanistan. It's Iraq. It's Libya. Right? And it's all failure, 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 failure. That is a thoroughly unempirical and ahistorical account of the management of fragile states and the response to fragile states of the last quarter century. If you look at levels of violence and levels of war between 1992 and about 2009, it declined in every region of the world. And it did so largely because of a series of interventions and investments in peacekeeping and peace building, et cetera, through the World Bank, through the UN, through the United States, et cetera. Now, that trend is reversed as we watch new violence in the Middle East. But it doesn't mean that we should forget that you can actually succeed in doing these things, that we've kind of lost the memory of success, and I think that it distorts our policy in a major way. That's the good news. The bad news is in terms of the long-term business of helping a society maintain a degree of inclusive politics, reduce violence, create conditions for foundational growth, etc. I think we're very bad at that. The kinds of things you just said, Sharon, I don't disagree with a single word that you said, but I'm struck by how late the U.S. government has come to that conclusion, the World Bank has come to that conclusion. Word for word, the things you said are in the Agenda for Peace from 1992, right? Word for word.
Yep.
We've known this for a very long time, but our institutions have evolved extraordinarily slowly to do these kinds of things effectively. And so slowly that it seems to me that we still don't have decent multilateral tools to do the core of this. And I would define the core in a similar terms to what you did. It's the blending of diplomacy, politics, security, development, et cetera. But when I look at the kinds of cases we're dealing with, the kinds of issues we're dealing with, the core challenge, important to deal with health, it's important to deal with roads, it's important to deal with all these things, but the core challenge is inclusive political institutions, institutions for public order, processes for political negotiation, the growing spread of the rule of law. All right? Now, I'm going to oversimplify, but we basically have two kinds of tools. We have developmental tools, which are quite good at institution building, but by sort of ideology and history and practice shy away from engaging in the security space or even really the political space. And we have political institutions, diplomatic ones, the UN, peacekeeping, and they're pretty good at interfering in the political and security space, but they don't do institution building. So you can do short-term responses to the political and security space, and you can do long-term responses in the financial, economic, health, public infrastructure space. We don't actually have tools for long-term responses and fostering institution building in the political and security space. There are little exceptions here and there. But as an overall structure, we're very weak at the core of this problem.
Can I just, I mean, sorry, because
sure.
I absolutely agree. I mean, it is about the integration of the political into development. And there are good reasons why you don't want to do that. Because, you know, when I was working for an NGO, if you got too political, you got kicked out of the country. So you have to find a way to integrate politics into technical development without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And to me, that's very much a layered approach. You do have to protect development and humanitarian actors from becoming overtly political, or they can't work.
Thanks. Joel, I mean, this was two challenges from your last incarnation at the World Bank.
One of the exceptions.
Bruce's comment that, you know, these institutions have taken a very long time to actually evolve, and be interesting to hear about what constraints you found in trying to move the World Bank in that direction. But then second, also this issue of political. I mean, the World Bank for decades has always said we're an apolitical organization and institution. I mean, they explicitly tried not to get involved in the politics, and here we are saying it's essential to get involved in the politics. How did you manage to address that?
Difficultly.
Right.
And first, we've started off on all the right issues that you've raised. And Bruce is absolutely right that these issues were understood and were core to a thinking about what's going to bring security and development. But the implementation of this has been beset by long-term difficulties related to the mandates of the different institutions, the different mindset preparation, understanding of different parts of our expertise. Both academic and practitioner. These are different worlds, and these different worlds don't easily come together. There's one aspect, though, that I want to raise regarding the development side, and then we can talk a little bit about the politics side. What I found as the biggest constraint in going deeply into the true issues that impact long-term institutional development and the relationship between political and economic factors is the approach to risk that development actors take and how that's changed over time. Because as we get to the last mile of poverty reduction, we are going to go into increasingly riskier environments. And by risk, I mean all forms of risk, right? The risk of failure, the risk of reputational damage, the true security and physical risks to staffing and people involved in development engagements. There are all of these greater risks. And frankly, many of the development institutions, first of all, were not necessarily created to work in that riskiest core of the market, if you will. They were created to work in stable environments, and for a long time it was, okay, let the UN create stability, and once there's stability, the development actors can come on board. So there was always that sense of these institutions were not established to work in that riskiest segment of the market. Second of all, since the 90s, over time, the institutions, all of the institutions, bilateral, we can, I'd be curious since JICA, how this affects JICA. I know in the U.S. institutions, the bilaterals, the multilaterals, is that the governance risk, the corruption risk, the risk of failure, the tolerance level for those risks has declined precipitously. So we expect all of our children to be A students. You know, we expect all of our projects to succeed. But when we go in these riskiest markets, we got to assume that a huge share of our projects are going to fail. That's the nature of working in those risky environments. We've got to assume a level of risk and reputational risk. We'll have to even assume a level of corruption and governance risks. We have to assume and deal with security risks in a different way than these institutions have been set up to do. And I think that these institutions, not only have they been slow to adopt those different approaches towards and attitudes towards risk, I would say that since the early 90s, they've become even less capable of taking a bold approach to those risks. And I think that's what's created such a difficult effort to adapt to the challenges of that last mile, if you will, that last sort of segment of poverty reduction. Now, on the politics side, well, that's the last thing I'll also say, you know, places like the World Bank have an explicit restriction built into the articles from the Bretton Woods Agreement establishing the institution that say these institutions were not to engage in domestic politics. We all know that everything they do is political, but there is a strong firewall between direct engagement. And therefore, one of the real obstacles of bringing the political in was how do you bring in political awareness into a development institution without being able to engage politically, explicitly politically. And that, I think, has been a challenge and will continue to be a challenge for development institutions for a long time to come. It requires better partnerships with the UN and multilaterals and bilaterals who can and have that ability. But that cooperation has proven difficult given that sort of tension between the political and the development side.
Thank you.
Quick two-finger on that.
Sure.
Just a quick two-finger. I very much agree with everything you said, Joel. Just on that last point about the bank's mandate to not be political, it seems to me that, you know, the drafting of that mandate was about the bank shouldn't be in the business of choosing between communism and democracy. It is so over-interpreted. And you have bank lawyers saying, oh, we can't be involved in providing finance to local police forces because it's political. And it seems to me that, we have way over-interpreted what that mandate actually restricts us from doing.
President Kitaoka, I wanted to come back. I mean, one of the implications of being risk-averse is you tend to look for short-term wins. And in your remarks, I think very importantly, you highlighted the gains that one could have by thinking about prevention, how much cheaper it is to engage in prevention. And you gave health systems as an example. Rather than dealing with the symptoms later. And obviously in conflict, prevention is also much cheaper than dealing exposed with these issues. And then you also gave examples about how important it is to try to, you know, win the hearts and minds of people, offer them some hope, you know, through interventions like a sports day, which I think many people would not have thought would have been one of the big priorities for a newly emerging country like South Sudan. But my point is that in all of these cases, the returns come in the long run. How do you manage the politics of lengthening time horizons so that people are prepared to engage in interventions that yield benefits in the long term rather than always going for the, you know, the quick fix.
Before responding to this question, can I just say a few words about Afghanistan?
Please.
And other situations? Certainly, I have to admit that human security can work in a fragile state, or at least in the countries where some stability is achieved, not in a totally failed countries. But, you know, if you look at some countries which are called as failed states, there are some stable places, stable regions to which we can make some assistance. And we have to be very patient in our approach. First of all, if there is a real failed state, we have to, that's a place where diplomacy has to play important role, backed by military forces. Not the military forces first. Diplomacy to urge the compromises among those competing factions. That's very, very important by, threatening by military forces, at the same time by showing some inducements by money, and then let's urge some compromise. And let's do not make a too hasty approach. I made my first visit to Afghanistan in 2002, February, and I visited Herat, which was governed by Ismail Khan, which was like a medieval age place, but stable, you know. There was a rather hasty approach for centralization under Karzai, which was one of the causes of failure. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I'm a rather supporter of the regionalism and also parliamentary democracies, where compromises are easy than presidential systems. If we bring a presidential system in which winner takes all, then the competition, fighting among the competing factions become tense, very difficult to stop. And that's one thing. Also, when we look at the world situation as a whole, except for the extreme Muslims, this is terrible. But in other areas, the peacekeeping operation is going out from Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire. The situation in Somalia is not good, but better than 10 years ago. We should not be desperate all and all. The number of the casualties is not particularly increasing in Afghanistan. Therefore, we have to have international cooperation with a vision for the future, which should not be very hasty one, which should not be very idealistic one, but very much practical one. Then let me go back to respond to your questions. One more thing about the first question. Human security is not almighty at all. Or there's no panacea for the issues like failed states. But still we have to support the people where they are living in a relatively stable places by supporting their livelihood, agriculture, and so forth, and also strengthening, bringing about the security sector reform, strengthening the police, which had to be started from the identifying good police. This is a very difficult one. Also, if we try to bring an ideal kind of solution in a too hasty manner, it's very difficult. For example, when we had an election in Afghanistan, how to exclude the Taliban-related candidates, which is a very terribly difficult job, and which did not have a very good impact on the process in the long run. Okay, let's go back to the question. But how to get migrant herds, and how prevention is important. This is a relative evaluation that certainly prevention is better. So the another issue is, you know, how to divide the powers into the regions. Just look at Africa. Most of the African countries are in presidential system, except for Morocco, which is a kingdom. And Ethiopia is a bit similar to the parliamentary democracy. The power is divided. So let's urge them to make compromise. That's a very important thing. And while they are refraining from the conflict, we can support the assistance, we can provide the support, then you can get the you can continue to get the support as far as you stop fighting. So this is an important approach. Also, I think one thing which is not very well known to the international community and which is Japanese government is doing, the urge, how to urge the dialogue among the conflict groups. For example, into Iraq, we invite those Iraq leaders to Japan. And then there are two purposes. One is please show how Japan stood up again from the defeat. And then just look at the secrets or the reasons why Japan was successful in recovering. One thing. Another hidden agenda is to make them discussion, to ask them discussion while they are traveling. And then this is, you know, useful. You know, in I'm really afraid that when Iraq government is looks prevailing over Daesh, the immediately the Saudi-Iran conflict is rising up. And also the Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds conflict may start in them. Therefore, there should be another the conditionality from us. As far as you can continue this agreement, then we can provide, continue this one. Again, I have to admit that there's no panacea because the also the because the major players are the people over there. Unless they are determined to come to peace, we cannot force them, but we have to persuade them that there will be a better future if you make compromise.
Thank you. So, very quickly, I'm going to ask each of you to just respond to one last question before we throw it open for Q&A, and that's the question of money. So, you know, today lots of people look at defense establishments and say that's where all the money is, and now we've combined these notions of defense security and development. Maybe there'll be lots more money for addressing the kinds of issues that we've been talking about. Others are very worried that by putting more money into a situation, you just create more rent-seeking and more conflict to get those rents. So, Bruce, in 30 seconds, more money is a something we should strive for in this area or something we should be cautious of? And you can't say both.
Different money. We should be able to pay for things like stabilizing local police forces, justice institutions, rule of law training, et cetera. And who cares whether it's a development activity or a security activity? It's an irrelevant distinction that we impose on realities which are much more organic.
Mm-hmm. So find a problem and solve that problem. Sharon.
The smartest programs I've ever seen that actually are able to show they can reduce violence, and you can actually develop measures to show that, are quite small. And I think there is still very little money for those types of programs that blend development and peace building and have a diplomatic layer. But the bottom line is you have to do those programs first, and then you can flow the big money in. Because you have a stable environment in which to do development. So I would actually say small money up front to lay the groundwork, to set the stage for big money later.
So there's enough in things like the Peace Building Fund?
Oh, no. No, there isn't enough for this kind of peace building work. But there is more than enough that we are dumping into places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya next, Syria next.
shift the composition.
Shift the conversation. The amount of money, the billions we poured into those places is not working.
Joel.
Yeah, more money, better distributed. I mean, the bottom line is that if you look at the sum total of countries that you would say are fragile or conflict affected or at risk, it's feast or famine, mm-hmm. right? So there are a small number of countries mm-hmm. that are far over-aided. And in fact, the aid itself has become the problem, mm-hmm. right? The effects, the potential overloading of domestic institutions, the competition, that has become the problem. And yet at the same time, I would say, you know, three fragile states make up somewhere in the order of 70 to 75% of all funds flows in the, however you want to define, in the 35, 40 countries that we identify as fragile and conflict affected. If you look at the average country that's not in the headlines, that's not impacted by these kinds of high-profile things, they are far under-supported. Very far in comparisons to other standard developing countries. So I think we have to look seriously at the distribution of funding, but recognize that the massive amounts of aid that went into the small numbers doesn't mean that the overall level of aid to fragile and conflict-affected states is high relative to other development challenges.
So many institutions, including IDA and DFID and others, have actually got specific targets for we're going to do this much in fragile and conflict-affected states. Are you in favor of those kinds of average aggregate targets?
I'm in favor of targets that not necessarily are average, because I think that you have to pay attention to the distribution. What concerned me is that in many organizations, for some time, that aid was the aid formula, and this is essentially the truth in IDA, was based on a formula in which governance indicators were wrapped into the formula. As a result, they're always going to perform at the bottom of all governance indicators by definition. So they were going to get less on a per capita basis than more well-governed environments, which seems to be not being forward-looking in trying to distribute aid to the countries that needed it most. So as a result, I think the overall envelope on the multilateral side, it's not true on the bilateral side, of course, mm-hmm. but on the multilateral side, the overall envelope is far smaller than it should be relative to the share of not where poverty is now, but where poverty is likely to be in 15 years. And I think we need to change that, and formulas that push that, and I was behind mm-hmm. that at IDA and the distribution, is a way of pushing donors to that. And they're nervous about it because of the risks involved in seeing more money go to those areas.
President Kitaoka, is JICA going to have a target for how much assistance it will provide?
I quite agree with the common notion of more money in a different way. That's very different. But how to bring those money? Another important topic is how to bring private money, mm-hmm. Cooperation with the private partners, which is very important. In a different situation from security area, one big success was Olicet, which was done by Sumitomo Chemical in Japan, which was a very effective net against mosquito. If you are sleeping in this net, mm-hmm. you can be safe against malaria, which totally helped probably several millions of people in the 10 years or so. And also now it is very much insisted that how to make a cooperation with private sector is very, very important. But at the same time, nowadays the new donors are rising. Therefore, I think more and more cooperation between the donors in advanced democracies is very necessary, like JICA, USAID, DFID, France, Netherlands, Australia, Canada. I think which has been started. We are trying to promote more of a cooperation between us, rather than through the United Nations, which is a huge bureaucracy. What I'm trying to say is that all the happy families are similar. All the unhappy families are individual. So we have to find out what's the real causes of unhappiness in each country and try to address to those countries with the individual attention, by the cooperation with the advanced donors, with the cooperation from NGOs.
Thank you. Questions from the audience. We've got lots. Please wait for a microphone to come. Identify yourself and ask a question. We'll start right there at the back, which is closest to the microphone. We'll take a few questions, and then I'll ask the panelists to respond.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. In getting an economic consensus of what the people want to do in their area and getting the funding together, could you use the internet to get some transparency?
We get a mic up here in the front. We can start with the lady over there.
Thank you. I am Irene Hila. I come from Greece. I'm a professor of international relations in Athens University. So thank you for your interesting lecture. I would like to ask for you one question. We all know that in order for a country to play a role of leadership in global affairs, it has to process this kind of carrot and stick diplomacy. What do you think that would be this policy for Japan in the very near future? Thank you.
Thank you. Keep coming down. Yeah, this gentleman.
Hi, my name is Patrick Wickland. I work for the Foreign Agricultural Service at the USDA. You were talking about some of the long-term problems that you have with institution building. I see in my own agency that when we're doing technical capacity building and scientific capacity building, that's bringing ministries together in some of these places, and it's sort of they're doing the politics organically, kind of on their own, and we're just there with our technical experts. So I guess my question is for you, Professor Hillman. Have you seen any sort of research on, government agencies like the USDA or the Department of Energy that are doing capacity building type work and that being sort of more effective as soft diplomacy because people are maybe scared of the State Department or distrustful?
Fair.
Thank you. The lady right here.
My name is Deirdre LePin. I'm currently a consultant. I've worked on staff for many bilateral and multilateral organizations and also for a major oil company in development. My question follows the last one to a large extent. It has to do with institutions. We've been talking about them. Institutions are composed of people, and the quality of those institutions depends to a very large extent on the quality of the people's ideas, the quality of their cooperation among themselves, and the quality of their ability to be political, that is, to make things happen among themselves. Now, the question that I have is that we in development do far too little in building a relationship between people, building social capital, funding people-to-people programs, which then ultimately can change and make more stable the institutions those people are involved in. And so I'm wondering how we can get organizations to fund people-to-people type activities. I was just, for example, evaluating one where just in two states of northern Nigeria, 5,670 people were trained to do house-to-house health education. And the only complaint about the program after the evaluation was there weren't enough of those people, and they didn't stay long enough in the household because they didn't have the time. So this is expensive, but it works.
Can be expensive, but also can be with volunteers, and I hope you come back in a couple of months. We're going to have a big event on volunteering, and the gentleman over there.
Thank you very much for a great presentation. My name is Elliot Hurwitz. I was a former colleague of Jaime Caras at the World Bank, and I was in the State Department and was a member of the intelligence community. This question came up in the presentation. I don't remember by whom. Who are the spoilers in economic development? So I would appreciate if anyone could answer that question, please.
Okay. I'm going to go back to the panel. and maybe not ask you to each answer all of the questions. So, Joel, let me start with you, and there was a specific question addressed to you on capacity building. Also use the opportunity if there are any sort of, you know, final pithy takeaways that you would like the audience to have. This is your chance.
Okay. Well, quickly on capacity building, and it relates to your people and the people comment as well, because I do think this is core. And, you know, one of the things that was mentioned here by Bruce and Sharon and others is that the amount of success that you have sort of seen in a number of countries. But it's interesting to see is that what you see is reasonably significant success in rebuilding a state of delivery of service, often equivalent or slightly better than it was prior to the conflict. And all the rest of the efforts to kind of enhance good governance and create much kind of more complex institutional frameworks in these countries at a very, very low level of development, they fail. So we're more successful, actually more successful than we know at restoring capacity, mm-hmm. and we're terribly unsuccessful mm-hmm. At raising that capacity to levels that I actually think are unlikely to ever be achieved in the time frame that we think they can be achieved. So our capacity building efforts largely fail because our understanding of how capacity develops, the time frame that it takes to create that kind of people-centric approach to development is entirely different than the 3-5 year time frames that we have in our development projects. So I think that we really do have to fundamentally rethink the way we understand development and then we move development. And so my last pithy reminder is, who are the spoilers? I have to say, to some extent, we are the spoilers. Because we place expectations on countries at extremely low levels of development that are looking at a generational path of the development of individual capacity and institutional capacity that we want to truncate into a political cycle of, you know, 4 years, 8 years. And that is actually often at the root of our expectations of what goes wrong.
Thank you. Sharon, I wonder if I think spoilers was your term, and so you might want to you know, absolve yourself from Joel's accusation. But also there was a question on internet and transparency, and I know that State Department has always been a big believer in promoting transparency, open government, et cetera. Maybe you'd take that.
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about some of these. I'm afraid I'm going to have to not talk about the internet one, only because I know absolutely nothing about it. So I'm afraid I won't.
Talk about spoilers.
All right, I will talk about spoilers, yeah. Gladly. And this does touch on your individuals and institutions question as well, and the scary State Department. So for me, yes, this, Deirdre, this is one of the most central challenges to the way we do development. And this is why I think there needs to be a much closer alignment between development and diplomacy. In governance programs in development, and I started out in the Democracy Center at USAID, so I'm a huge believer in governance programs, they are very technical. It's this notion that if we build the right technical types of institutions, we promulgate the right kinds of laws, all of a sudden the people who inhabit those institutions are going to be operating under a different set of incentives and rules. And that's just not true. If you have spent your whole life in Afghanistan or Iraq or Libya or Syria, where, you know, corruption is the only way to survive, zero-sum competition is the nature of the game. I mean, for us to sort of assume you build the institution and that will change the individuals who inhabit it and the way they've survived, that's just ridiculous. And I think there are a lot of people who can come around to see the compromise is a better way. That takes time. There are a lot of very good programs out there that get into these institutions and teach negotiation and mediation training so people can begin to see that there's a way to get to a positive solution. But this leads to the question of spoilers. There are some people who are never going to accept that there is a way to compromise or that there is a way to come to a win-win solution because they stand to benefit from instability. And those are the people, those are the spoilers that I think only diplomacy can constrain. And even then, let's not overstate what diplomacy can do. You know, you can pick up the phone, you can make calls, you can do certain things. Another thing that we're exploring is how do you mobilize domestic coalitions to put pressure on spoilers? Because usually those coalitions, they pay attention to those coalitions more than they pay to external actors. But the bottom line is if you don't deal with those spoilers, there is nothing you can do. They will capture and control every institution you try and build.
Thank you. Bruce, let me come to you. You've written about spoilers quite extensively, so I'm sure you've got some thoughts on that. But there was also an interesting question on carrot and stick, and we've talked a lot about the carrots that we have at our disposal, not so much about sticks, if you've got any thoughts about that.
I'm all about the sticks.
Yeah, I know.
Look, in the kinds of hard spoilers that Sharon was just talking about, there are situations where the only credible answer is to defeat them. It's not to buy them off. It's not to include them. It's to defeat them, and I defeat them militarily. And we've had reasonable success in doing that in a number of in peacekeeping operations and multinational operations, et cetera. And that just has to be part of the toolkit. It's very hard when you get into places, which is where we are now. One of the things we haven't talked about in this panel is all the references that we've had are to the kinds of places we've been dealing with in the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. We're about to have these conversations in a whole different context. Right? What about spoilers in Syria? I mean, that's just a totally different kind of ball game if you look at the sophistication and the level of military capability, right? So these issues are all about to get much harder than they've been. But in the kinds of cases we've been talking about, sometimes you simply have to defeat spoilers. So that's the stick issue. And carrots can be involved in peeling people away from spoilers, but minus the stick, it doesn't work. The last point that I wanted to make is just to build on Joel's about timeframes. When we did the World Development Report on conflict security development, we took a look at what it takes for a society to evolve by one level of governance, right? So we're not talking about how do you become Denmark. We're talking about how do you become Botswana, right? How do you become a relatively stable, lower middle income country? What's the time frame that it takes? If you assume the fastest rates of growth ever seen in recorded human history, and you apply them to Afghanistan now, it takes about 150 years to get to Botswana. Okay? So the chasm between the time frames of what history tells us it takes human societies to evolve and the kind of 3 to 5 year productization of governance, I mean, it's massive, right? So we have to have a completely different way of thinking about that kind of problem. Afghanistan's an extreme case, but even when you look at less extreme cases, you're talking about a couple of generations for transformation of the rules of politics or the kinds of relationship between institutions, rules, and people that can actually produce stable, inclusive politics.
Thank you. President Kitaoka, last word is yours.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. Again, on the spoilers. Spoilers are can be defined that those people who find more benefits than defying against the agreement. If there is a kind of a diamonds, then they may be able to get it by not following the international consensus. So I found that because Japan is a resources country, when I first visited Africa, I found that there's a world like cause of resources. Resources can be the cause of the fighting. That's one thing. If one finds more benefit, then they can fight, they can defy against the consensus. The other is that if they are afraid of too much damage from them, then they can fight. They may fight from their despair. That's, again, one of the reasons. So we have to avoid that. That relates to the carrots and stick issue. Carrots and sticks, you know, nowadays, because, you know, military technology is so advanced, carrots cannot be, stick cannot be used easily. We have to, first of all, look at and try to do reduce the number of the spoiling the different countries. The last country might be North Korea, probably, which is terribly guarded by nuclear weapons. We cannot communicate directly to the people. This is the most difficult case. Therefore, we have to make much more effort to send a message to the people over there. I cannot imagine any other effective way to reach to those people. And in carrots, how to bring carrots to common people is another difficult kind of thing. Once the United States OCHA wanted to bring some humanitarian assistance to North Korea, but because of transparency, it should be accompanied by home visits, whether or not the assistance is just delivered to the appropriate places, which they don't like. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they decline to get us support. This is very, very difficult. But as a whole, the showing some embracement, showing some understanding is very important. In this regard, I have to show that we are engaged in a kind of a dialogue to promote a mutual understanding of the civilization and religions. As was introduced by Homi, I was president of International University of Japan, which is a very unique university, a private university, only graduate school, and then 80% of the students are from foreign countries. The biggest body is from Islamic countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, Central Asia, even now Afghanistan, many people from Afghanistan. And the second biggest group is Buddhism, including Japan, Thailand, Sri Lanka, Myanmar. They exist peacefully, friendly. And then that's a good way of, they can find out the way to coexist over there. And they can become friendly in a two-year life in dormitory. Also, Japan has been doing a kind of a cultural dialogue across the religions. I once was a part of this dialogue. Our team was headed by a Japanese Buddhist who had a PhD in Islamic studies. This is a very unique case, you know. We cannot expect that we can reach an agreement in a short period of time. That's totally impossible. But showing our attitude that we are ready to listen to your opinion is very important.
Thank you. Thank you. So I think that that's a very hopeful note on which to end. So please join me in thanking our panel for a wonderful discussion.